Now, to set up the story, we want to take you back into that land where Esther and Mordecai and the Jewish people had ended up, that land that's kind of current Iraq in the Near East. Our reading is going to come from right in the middle of the book of Esther. So it's right in the middle of the story, and I hope that you will find time to go this week to the book of Esther and read more of it yourselves, because you will learn so much more. The Israelites were still in exile in that area of the Babylonian captivity. The Persians had come in and conquered the Babylonians, and today's story takes place in the city of Susa, which is the capital of the Persian Empire. The king of Persia has just conducted a nationwide search for a new queen. You'll find out why he needed a new queen if you read the story. And he selects the beautiful Esther, who becomes the queen of Persia. And now the king doesn't know that she's a Jew. And in the course of his rule as king, he approves a request by one of his trusted advisors, Haman, who you saw in that little video. He signs this decree that will lead to the slaughtering of all of the Jews on a very specific date. And upon hearing the news of this impending massacre, Mordecai, Esther's uncle, the one who raised her from birth, essentially, who is still a commoner, even though his niece is now queen, puts on sackcloth and ashes. He publicly weeps and wails standing at the palace gate after the decree goes out. And he pleads with Esther to go to the king to get him to change that deadly decree. Yet Esther isn't sure that she can, because going before the king without permission is punishable by death. So, here is the reading. When Mordecai learned all that had been done, Mordecai tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went through the city wailing with a loud and bitter cry. He went up to the entrance of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth. In every province, wherever the king's command and his decree came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and lamenting. And most of them lay in sackcloth and ashes. When Esther's maids and her eunuchs came and told her, Esther was deeply distressed. She sent garments to clothe Mordecai so that he might take off his sackcloth, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called out for Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, who had been appointed to attend her, and ordered him to go to Mordecai to learn what was happening and why. Hathach went out to Mordecai in the open square of the city in front of the king's gate, and Mordecai told him all that had happened to him and the exact sum of money that Haman had promised to pay into the king's treasuries for the destruction of the Jews. It was something like 10,000 silver bars. Mordecai also gave him a copy of the written decree issued in Susa for their destruction, that he might show it to Esther, explain it to her, and charge her to go to the king to make supplication to him and entreat him for her people. Hathach went and told Esther what Mordecai had said. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a message from Mordecai, saying, all the king's servants and all the people of the king's provinces know that if any man or woman goes to the king inside the inner court without being called, there is but one law. All alike are to be put to death. Only if the king holds out the golden scepter to someone may that person live. I myself have not been called to come into the king for 30 days. When they told Mordecai what Esther had said, Mordecai told them to reply to Esther, do not think that in the king's palace you will escape any more than all the other Jews. For if you keep silence at such a time as this, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another quarter, but you and your father's family will perish. Who knows? Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this. Then Esther said in reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf, and neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will also fast as you do. After that, I will go to the king, though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything that Esther had ordered him. Earlier this week, I was in a meeting, and somebody asked me, why on earth are we reading Esther in the season of Advent? It just doesn't make sense. And I thought it was a brilliant question. But I started thinking about the message that Nate preached here last week. If you were here, you heard him preach a message about how can we wait? How can we wait with all of the injustice that's going on in the world right now? How can we wait? And yet he talked about how even as we cry out about injustice, we can wait with hopeful expectation for what God will do, even when we're feeling a sense of hopelessness. That's what Mordecai did in this story. When the decree was issued naming a date on which all of the Jews would be exterminated, he put on sackcloth and ashes, which were public signs of mourning, and he walked about the city in very public view, wailing and moaning. He took his frustration public so that people would not be in the dark about this heinous decree and the injustice that it would do by slaughtering innocent Jews. That's what I think the people in Ferguson are doing down in Missouri and around the world. They're demonstrating to let the world know that they stand against the kind of systemic racism that leads to unjust incarceration rates and the kinds of tragedies that are absolutely filling our newspapers these days. Mordecai did what was in his power to do. He demonstrated, and then he used his network of connections to effect change by getting word to the people who might have the power to do something. He didn't act powerless. He used the power and the connections that he had. Part of Mordecai's power was the influence that he wielded in Esther's life. He was her uncle, to be sure, but he had raised her since childhood. Her parents were victims of war. She was an orphan. And so he had the power that all of us parents have to influence our children's thinking. And he wanted to teach Esther how to use her power, the power she had by virtue of her position as queen. But Esther was a foreigner in a strange land. She was the immigrant. She was the minority. She was a casualty of war. She was an orphan. She was a woman in a place and a time where women counted for nothing, even if they were queen. And if you read the early part of the story of Esther, you'll see what I mean about that. Esther was in the religious minority, targeted for annihilation. And yet, she had power to wield. She had the power of her position and her closeness to the king, if she had the courage to speak out instead of remain silent. And she did. She called on God through prayer and through fasting, and she called on her people to support her in the fast. And then she worked cleverly within the space that her position provided her and the culture allowed her. And she did a great thing. She unmasked an evil man in the king's court and stopped him from orchestrating the destruction of an entire people. She stopped ethnic cleansing in its tracks. Would that we could all learn from Esther and Mordecai to use the power that is ours without fear, to make inroads against that kind of injustice and to bring God's peace a little closer to earth. If there's one thing that I hope you will remember from the story of Esther and from our time together in worship today, it is Mordecai's words to Esther, just two of his words, "Perhaps you." He said to Esther, "Perhaps you have come to royal dignity for just such a time as this. Perhaps you, Esther, can do something here. Perhaps you can make a difference." What if every time you witnessed some untoward thing happening, some injustice, no matter how small, some act of evil or oppression or unkindness, what if you would let yourself hear those words? Perhaps you would have the power to effect change. No matter who you are or where you are, you have power to effect change. I think that's what President Obama did when he used his executive power to make those changes to immigration policy. He was so frustrated with Congress, and yet he realized, perhaps I could do something. And so he did it. I think that's what our bishop, Patricia Lull, along with all of the other bishops in the ELCA, did when they supported President Obama's actions and asked the Congress to go further in immigration reform with a public letter that the entire Council of ELCA bishops signed, stating this, among other things: "As a people of faith and leaders of the church, we support public policy that protects children, reunites families, and cares for the most vulnerable, regardless of their place of birth. While today's action addresses a pressing need, it does not provide a path to citizenship, establish policies that prioritize family unity, or create more efficient channels for entry of new migrant workers. Our hope is that Congress will address these and related issues, including the practice of family detention, which undermines our values as a people of faith and a nation of welcome." You can read the statement in its entirety on our St. Paul Area Synod website. Now, you might be thinking, you're not Queen Esther, you're not President Obama, you're not Bishop Lull. But all they did was use the power and authority and access that they had right where they were. Will Willimon said, "What Esther did was not particularly spectacular, but that's what makes this a good story, because most of us are not very spectacular people." And then he goes on to say, "But that's okay, because most of the good that God needs doing is not too spectacular. But what God needs doing may require you to hear the words, 'Perhaps you.'" Just this week, just a week ago, I was in a meeting where the man that had the most power and authority in the room thought he was being funny. He was just trying to get a laugh. And he came out with the most sexist joke that I've heard in 3 decades. And it demeaned every one of his female staffers that was in the room. And it was so bad that you could feel the oxygen leach out of the room as soon as he had said it. And people tried to make themselves laugh because that was what he was trying to get from us. But I sat there thinking, who is going to tell him he cannot make jokes like that? And then I heard Mordecai's words. perhaps you, Pam. And then this week I was studying the text with a pastor friend of mine who's new in a church, and she was telling me a story about how this fall, her first fall with them, she learned that they had decided to move the fall big church picnic inside the walls of the church because a homeless shelter had just opened across the street, and the congregation members didn't want those people to think that the free food was for them. Well, I think now she's hearing Mordecai's words saying, perhaps you could do something about that. It's interesting, my son is now 24 years old, and I still remember him telling me with a lot of distress back when he was in high school about a friend of his, a friend where he spent lots of time. They were family friends of ours, wonderful family, and he said that this friend of his was just hatefully cruel to his mother who provided hospitality to all of these high school boys, and provided them food, that he would just slice her to smithereens in front of his friends. And I'm thinking, if only Hunter had heard the words, perhaps you, Hunter, could say in front of this friend, I love your mom. She's awesome. And I really don't like it when you treat her like that. I wish she was my mother. Perhaps you could stop something like that from going on. I think too often we are terrified of causing a rift in a friendship or a rift in our family or a rift in our employment situation. But we're not facing death like Esther was. What are we so scared of? To stand up for something that's right. David Weiss wrote a book called To the Tune of a Welcoming God that our congregation members, many of them, read when we were grappling with the issue of openness to people who are gay and lesbian. He wrote the book about his coming out as an advocate for the GLBT community. And he said early in the book that while he had always been openly supportive of his gay and lesbian friends behind closed doors, it took an event to pull him public with his advocacy. He said that in the weekly school magazine at the school where he taught, a student anonymously published a poem entitled Living in Fear. And it was reading that poem that helped him to hear the words, perhaps you, David, need to speak publicly. And he said he wrote a response for the next week's issue of that student magazine, saying this: I see now that if God keeps silent in the face of your anguish, it is only because I wouldn't lend God the use of my words. Of course, that's our choice. Whether we lend God the gifts that are ours or not, whether we respond like Esther did to the calling, perhaps you. It's our choice. But friends, rest assured that whether we choose to speak or act or to cower and hide, God will raise up advocates from another quarter, because God will always act to stop injustice. But wouldn't you love to be part of God's peace coming into the world? Perhaps you would. Thanks be to God.